Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. My name is Christian Expo Nielsen. I am Associate Professor of History and Human Security at Aarhus University in Denmark. My guest for today's episode is the cultural anthropologist Andrew Gilbert, who is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and senior researcher at the university's ethnography lab. Andrew Gilbert is joining me today from Berlin, where he currently resides. Today, we will be discussing his 2020 book, International Intervention and the Problem of Legitimacy, Encounters in Postwar Bosnia-Herzegovina, published by Cornell University Press. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to discussing this book, which raises so many interesting questions about the international presence in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Let us first go back to the origins of this book. I know that you've done incredibly extensive fieldwork in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So how and why did you decide to write this particular book?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the origins of the book actually go way back to when I was doing a master's degree at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in the mid-90s. At that time, the Bosnian War, the Dayton Agreement, which brought the war to a close, and the post-war international intervention that was to supervise that agreement, all of that, all of those things were topics of widespread discussion and debate when I was in this MA program. There was a widespread approach that saw post-war Bosnia as a kind of laboratory where the institutions of the international community would have the widest latitude to transform this formerly socialist and then conflict-ridden country in ways that reflected the emerging then post-Cold War norms of liberal peace, democracy, and an economy organized around capitalist market principles. And I remember back then wondering what all of these grand plans would actually look like on the ground, perhaps skeptical about the confidence with which such far-reaching transformations were being discussed, transformations that would have to be simultaneously political, social, cultural, historical, and so on. And so for me at the time, it became clear that only an anthropological and an ethnographic approach would accommodate my skepticism and satisfy my curiosity. So when it came to doing the research in Bosnia, I was really interested in seeking out those sites or places where international intervention could be observed, where there were regular interactions between those called internationals and those called locals. And at the time, that was the refugee return process. For those of people who don't know, it was an incredibly ambitious attempt to make possible and sometimes even compel the return of refugees and displaced persons to their pre-war homes. The international community at that time was particularly interested in what was called minority return, that is, the return of refugees to areas in which they would be an ethnic minority. And so not only was that seen as a way to undermine the power of nationalists and undo some of the effects of the war and the tactics of so-called ethnic cleansing, eventually this process became seen as a vehicle for broader goals of political transformation. And therefore, refugee return drew in all these different international institutions from foreign aid organizations, embassy staff, all the multiple organizations of the UN, the OSCE, NATO peacekeepers, they were all involved in all these different processes in the name of return. And the effort also included a Bosnia-specific institution called the Office of the High Representative, which wield extraordinary powers and exercise them to support refugee return, including imposing property legislation, changing the constitution, and removing elected and appointed officials from office. And so what I saw in my field work, right? So once I was able to hit the ground and observe all of these interactions, what I saw in my field work was far more complex than what was being discussed in most of the scholarship. And this is what I worked to capture then in the book, what I call the open-ended, innovative, and unpredictable nature of international intervention that is usually omitted from the kind of ordered representations of the technocratic vision, but also the confident assertions of many critiques. And as I argue in the book, then, this is clearest, this open-ended, innovative, unpredictable nature of intervention is clearest when you analyze what I ended up calling intervention encounters. And so in the book, that is the framework for seeking to understand, to capture, and to some degree correct what I felt was a limited view of international intervention. I hope that's enough of a kind of opening salvo to describe the book.
That was indeed quite an opening salvo. And I think one of the things that we maybe should mention right away, and you mention it yourself in the book, is that not only were you as a foreign citizen, resident in Bosnia and Herzegovina for a much longer time than many international representatives, but you also importantly speak local language or languages, obviously language itself being a highly politicized topic in Bosnia Herzegovina.
Yeah, that's right. I was there for the bulk of my field work for about 16 months, and that was preceded by about 4 months of across two summers and maybe a month worth of follow-up research after that period. So yeah, got to spend a lot of time there. And as I say in the book, that that makes a huge difference both in the kind of learning process, but also in terms of forming relationships that were critical to being able to do the research itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that that I and others know as well from firsthand experience. Now, obviously, none of us just wake up one morning and write a book because we suddenly thought about this idea. Our books are themselves products of the influences that other books and researchers have had on us. So could you perhaps speak a bit about what books and other researchers inspired you as you worked on this particular book?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I was thinking about this, and if I think about, so once it became clear to me that it was the encounter that I needed to focus on, that the encounter, which is to say the coming together, the engagement of those often called foreigners and those often called Bosnians, to see that as a productive space where international intervention or whatever is going to come out of international intervention is going to be produced in that encounter. If I think about once I got to that point, it was clear that already I was being kind of influenced by, interestingly enough, anthropologists and scholars of colonialism, mostly because of their recognition of the complexity of the colonial encounter across difference and across inequality. They were among the first to question the notion of a uniform imposition of social categories and governmental rules and cultural forms. And that was really important to me. So I'm thinking here of authors like Ann Stoller and Barney Cohn and Jean and John Komaroff, among others. It was really kind of influential. And this is, you know, again, this is the anthropology kind of training that I had. So it wasn't necessarily other scholars of international intervention or theorists thereof, although I certainly engage with them. It really was those scholars who had studied and captured the complexity of encounters across difference and inequality that really were influential on the conceptualization of the book as a whole. Now, after that, it's hard to point to any particular authors, although certainly, again, as a general kind of influence, I have been influenced by those scholars and theorists who emphasize the performative nature of social and political life as a basic starting point for social analysis. And this is what introduced a basic approach in the book, which is to look at how people, first of all, to identify contradictions and instabilities and uncertainties that emerge in the intervention encounter, and then to look to see how people manage them. So again, a general approach. And then once we get into the individual chapters, well, it's really quite varied. For the first two chapters of the book, which deal very much with circulating mass media representations, I'm drawing upon general approaches to publicity by linguistic anthropologists. But then when we get later on into the book, I have a whole chapter about humanitarianism. And there I'm relating to and drawing upon social theorists and philosophers like Hannah Arendt, perhaps unexpectedly for some readers. So it's harder to kind of pinpoint larger influences because the chapters are in some ways so differentiated. But maybe I'll leave it at that.
I'll certainly raise my hand here and say that I was one of the readers who was surprised to see Hannah Arendt show up, as I'm much more familiar with her in the context of transitional justice and the
right.
various philosophical questions related to evil and the commission of atrocities. But I was also thinking of another scholar whom you certainly know, that given that you're an anthropologist, I couldn't help but wonder what a legendary anthropologist like Joel Halpern, with his studies of Serbian villages in the middle of the 20th century, would have made of an anthropologist, a North American anthropologist, going to Bosnia and essentially studying not so much the local population, but the local population's interaction with international actors, right? So that in itself is an interesting evolution and a very contingent one. Now, you already mentioned the issue of minority returns and introduced that term. Could you explain your choice of the municipalities of Prijedor and Sanski Most in northwestern Bosnia, the so-called axis of return, for your research?
Yeah. So again, once it became clear that what I was really interested in was being able to observe over a long period of time the kind of interactions, where the international kind of community actually hit the ground in ways that you could see and observe and analyze. I started looking around in the very early 2000s, looking for where can I do that. Where's the best place to do that? And at the time, this refugee return process was really picking up steam, and really it was there in that process where the most regular interactions between, again, all these UN bodies, OSCE, OHR, international aid organizations, you could see it on the ground. And so that's what drew me to refugee return. I didn't start out as interested in refugee return, but because that was the process where most of those interactions were taking place, that's what I focused on. And the place where that was happening in the most kind of massive scale when I started looking for a field site was in northwestern Bosnia, and in between these neighboring municipalities of Prijedor in the Republika Srpska side of Bosnia, and Sanski Most in the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina side. And what was fascinating, of course, is that these were neighboring municipalities separated by this so-called inter-entity boundary line. And you had Serbs who had been displaced from Sanski Most, living in Prijedor, were returning to Sanski Most, and Bosnian Muslims who had been pushed out of Prijedor returning to Priador. And so it was a very interesting kind of microcosm of a lot of the complexities and possibilities of international intervention. And it was one that unfolded over years, because as any field worker knows, you might identify something as a great place to do field work, but that doesn't mean you get to go immediately. You've got to plan and get the funding, et cetera. And then by the time you get there, maybe the thing you were so interested in studying is gone. And so what was so important for me about Priador and Sanski Most in this northwestern area was that refugee return was a process which unfolded over years. And so I could really kind of get in there and see it in its kind of full intensity over time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that you in a kind of almost experimental sense have let's say X heading back to Y and Y heading back to X is a really interesting kind of control methodology phenomenon that adds a lot to it. And of course the shared experience of this entire region, which was particularly ravaged, even by Bosnian standards, during, the war, makes it even more interesting. Moving on, one of the more fascinating aspects of your book is your analysis of what it means to be quote unquote political, both in the eyes of international representatives in Bosnia and Herzegovina and also among Bosnian citizens. Can you expand on why this term political has such a particular meaning in Bosnia?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're absolutely right that features pretty strongly across a number of chapters. And the reason that it does is because the question of the political or what counts as politics, there's a couple of reasons why that is featured so strongly. And the first one is that it's a widespread moral discourse in Bosnia when I was doing my field work. So if somebody wanted to criticize or stigmatize certain actions, they would call it political in a negative sense. And this is something I think that many listeners probably will be familiar with in their own kind of context, right? There is a way in which to call something political is a negative term. It is to criticize it. And this is true in Bosnia of foreigners as well as Bosnians and Herzegovinians, right? So there was this kind of moral discourse of politics that was common. And so I had to, by virtue of being a good empirical field worker, I had to take account of this. But the other reason why it features so strongly, which is related to the first, is that international actors of all kinds, but particularly those who called themselves humanitarians, defined their own legitimacy by being non-political or apolitical. And it turns out that that was a pretty challenging thing in a context where people were likely to see politics everywhere. And so as a researcher, there was also an additional challenge, which is that scholars often use the term politics to analytically discuss power relationships, right? So you think about the politics of state building or the politics of nationalism. And so I had to find a way to account for the local discourse, but as well as the nature of power involved when those local discourses were deployed. And so, so kind of unpacking the local nature of the discourse, what it did, what it revealed about the interactions between foreigners and Bosnians. But then I also had to somehow account for the effects of that on the relationships and the inequalities of power that emerged. And so it probably features the most directly in the chapter on humanitarianism, chapter 5, in which I really show the great lengths to which people who define themselves as humanitarian had to kind of regularly prove to others that they were not being political. And that was a real challenge and that kind of often was an instability that they had to manage in their relationships with a whole variety of others. And so, yeah, that's really kind of where I dig most deeply into that kind of that problematic nature of the political.
Yeah, and I think it challenges us, not just as scholars, but as citizens of our own societies, also to contemplate what being political and acting politically means for us, certainly as someone who has spent the most of his life in North America and Northern Europe, especially Northern Europe, I would say there's a much less negative connotation to being political. And I think you mentioned the pejorative notion of it is obviously there because there is a profound lack of trust in elected officials in the former Yugoslavia. And as you raise elsewhere in the book, this creates some interesting paradoxes in the sense that what does it mean when Bosnians profess, as some of your informants do, that they have, in a way, more confidence in unelected international officials who are flown in versus the people that they, in principle, themselves voted for, right?
Yeah, yeah, that is an interesting kind of observation for sure.
Now, your third chapter, and I have to say, I have a thing for good chapter titles. Your third chapter has the rather ingenious but also somewhat mysterious title, Doing Things with Ethnicity. What do you offer the reader with this chapter?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In fact, you know, in some ways, to me, this chapter is one of the earliest that I wrote because it deals with a topic that I probably struggled for the longest, and that is how to write about ethnicity and ethno-national identity and difference, and so, you know, in a social space like post-war Bosnia, where kind of ethno-national discourse saturates, or at least at the time, it's less so now, but at the time, it just saturated public discourse and private discourse for that matter. I was really interested in why and how that those sets of ideas about ethnic identity and difference were naturalized, how they came to be seen as part of everyday common sense. I knew as a kind of, you know, good social, you know, someone with some good social theory background that ideas about identity and difference like ethnicity are not natural phenomenon. They're human fabrications. And yet they come to be seen as taken for granted. And this presented me then with a conundrum because ideas about ethnicity were so bound up with the violence of the war and post-war politics, I didn't want to participate in the reproduction of those ideas. And yet as a researcher, I also had to be able to talk about the force of those ideas in Bosnian society, particularly the idea that, you know, once you know someone's ethnicity, well, then you know about their perspective and a whole range of issues, something that is false and yet is also widely accepted. So I asked myself a question, you know, how can I write about ethnicity in a way that denaturalizes it, but at the same time accounts for its force and its seeming ubiquity, right? This idea that it's everywhere. And then that led to a secondary question, which of course was about the role that such ideas played in the intervention encounter, right? So that they were very present as well there. So I had to be able to be able to write about this in this way. And that's where I think, you know, Roger Brubaker's formulation about groupness comes in handy. In a kind of well-known article and then later a very long book, he notes that although ideas about ethnicity posit ethnicity as something that pre-exists in the world, in fact, such identity, or what he calls groupness, is an event. There are times when it happens or is relevant, and there are times when it does not happen and is not relevant. He also notes that there's institutions or practices that give life to these categories of ethnic identity. He calls them ecological niches, government bureaucracies, schools. These are the kind of niches in which those categories take on a life, a social life. And so anyway, I developed an analytic framework, which I was, and I hope I'm successful in doing this. I developed an analytic framework to account for when groupness happens and when it does not, and the role that ideas about ethnicity played in the interactions between foreigners and Bosnians. And this meant, in part, seeing that people pursued various goals using these ideas. And so that's where the title comes from, doing things with ethnicity. In other words, that people would take these ideas, or at least the premises of these ideas, and they would then, you know, use them in their everyday lives as they're pursuing certain kinds of things. And this allowed me to account for how the ideas came to be seen as natural and how internationals participated in reproducing them, even as they disavowed any role in doing so, which was, again, this very interesting thing for me. I feel like I should stop there. I can talk about this for a long time, but really that was my kind of conundrum, being able to kind of talk about these things in ways that didn't naturalize and reproduce the categories, but at the same time could account for the social force and why foreigners, for example, could see them as natural ways to understand Bosnian politics and society, which for me was a really interesting question.
I think it's one of those conundra that we all have to deal with when we write about countries, societies like Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I know that I struggle with it constantly. It's very, very difficult when you're writing, for example, about the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, not at some point, I would say it's almost impossible not at some point to say the Croats did blah, 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 or the Serbs then launched blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, I mean, in a way, if the army of Republika Srpska launched an offensive, then it's acceptable, I think, shorthand, even for scholars, to say the Bosnian Serbs launched an offensive. But as Brubaker, and of course also another great colleague of ours, Catherine Baker, remind us in their works, it's easy to slip. At the same time, I think you highlight that this is not just something that happens among international representatives who come to Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's something that the local population does themselves. And again, that does not mean it's right. But as Brubaker would say, on the other hand, you can't ignore that it's happening. So when a Bosniak says that all Croats are doing such and such, or a Serb claims that all Montenegrins are behaving in a certain way, that's of course wrong, as you correctly state, but one also has to deal with the real world consequences of them actually thinking that. And as you say, then they are themselves doing things with ethnicity pursuant to those worldviews or those mental shortcuts that they make based on prejudices, stereotypes, etc. Now, in the same chapter, you also talk about double standards in terms of how the foreign staff of intergovernmental organizations or international governmental organizations condemn ethno-national ideology, but also themselves appropriate and operate within this ideology. Can you give an example or two, either from the book or other ones, of how you observe this in practice?
Yeah, so I would say some of the best descriptions. So there's two ways to, there's two pieces to an answer to that. The first one is to first note that part of the way that foreigners would often define themselves as different from Bosnians was to kind of disavow any kind of any interest in or participating in this kind of discourse of ethnic identity and difference, right? So Kim Coles in her book has a good description about the ways in which people would say, I don't see ethnicity, kind of performing this kind of liberal European individualism, right? Like, I only see the individual. I don't think in these categories. I'm not going to participate in this kind of this kind of context of the war in which ethnic difference was kind of promoted as the cause of the war in Bosnia. So it was a way of kind of performing their difference or categorize themselves as distinct from Bosnians. And so at the same time, however, they participated in reproducing those ideas all the time. And in the book, probably my favorite example is a moment where a member of the OSCE is been asked to meet with this woman who is part of a returnee organization. And she wants to tell him about a problem that she has observed with one of his interpreters, right? So he was, you know, as with most of the foreigners as who were part of the international intervention in Bosnia, he didn't speak, you know, BCS, and had interpreters, a local interpreter. And she was complaining, saying that she thinks that his interpreter was in some ways passing along information to local political parties about what conversations that were happening between the OSCE and at that time, Bosnian Muslim and Bosnian Croat returnees to a Serb majority area. And this interpreter, she said she thinks that he was passing along information to the mayor of the local town. And the OSCE officer did what I call, he made an interpretive leap. He interpreted her complaint to be about the fact that the interpreter was a Serb and that the local mayor was a Serb, and therefore she couldn't trust him as a Serb. And when he voiced this, she said, it has nothing to do with whether he's a Serb or not. It's just that he's unprofessional, right? He's not following the rules as he ought to. And so I took this as a really interesting moment because he had kind of already leapt to a conclusion by basing, you know, around these ideas about ethnic sameness and difference. She was a Bosnian Croat, the interpreter was a Bosnian Serb, the mayor was a Bosnian Serb, and he was seeing the social interaction through the category or through the lens of the categories of ethnic difference. And she kind of resisted that and said, this isn't what it is at all. And so that's just an example of the kind of routine and daily way in which, although internationals might say, you know, I don't see difference, you know, I see individuals for who they are, they project those categories onto Bosnian society and make decisions based upon them. And that was a really good example for me of one of those moments where he kind of leapt to a conclusion, even though that was the wrong conclusion.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Right, and I think it really shows how slippery that slope is, and again, all of the unintended consequences that start to come into play once one slips down that slope. Just for listeners who might not be that familiar with Bosnia-Herzegovina, let me just note that BCS is an acronym for Bosnian Croatian Serbian, which is used by the United Nations and other international organizations as a kind of shorthand for the three recognized languages in Bosnia, Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian, which are whatever their more nationalist adherents might argue otherwise, very much mutually intelligible. Now, at one point, you start in your book to talk about how foreigners permit themselves to be the adjudicators of when it is permissible to practice or signal a group identity, and when it is, on the contrary, being allegedly abused for strategic or political purposes. You also, citing Kimberly Coles, whom you've already mentioned, offer examples of both foreign actors who are very reductionist in assuming groupness through ethnic identity, while others, and I quote, attempted to nullify ethnicity as a salient category, end quote, by studiously ignoring or avoiding learning about the ethnicity of their local interlocutors. In other words, they worked with people who were Bosnian citizens, but basically said, I don't want to know what your ethnicity is. Mm-hmm. So here I'm going to try to challenge you a bit. Doesn't this kind of end up sounding a little bit like you and Coles are trying to have it both ways? That is, that it's on the one hand, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's wrong to ignore ethnicity, but also wrong to accept it as a quote-unquote fact. What then, a reader of your book might well ask, is the quote-unquote right or correct way of navigating groupness in a society like Bosnia?
Yeah, so, and it's a good question, and you know, it again is one of those tensions or contradictions that I think is really illuminating about, you know, living in, acting in Bosnian society at that time was, you know, trying to navigate these things. And of course, foreigners, when they would, you know, regularly kind of perform this, I don't care about ethnicity, don't tell me your identity, or they would, you know, sometimes ridicule others who would, you know, maybe not to their face, but behind their backs, who you know, would insist on you know, that there be differences between the Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian languages. And they would kind of say, ah, we all know that it's the same language, and they're just exploiting this set of differences, you know, for political ends. So in other words, this kind of undermining claims about ethnic difference as being kind of inauthentic or politicized. And yet at the same time, as I said earlier, they are participating regularly in interpreting Bosnian society and politics through the lens of ethnic difference. And so I would say, as a, you know, as an analyst or as a reader trying to figure out, well, how should I approach this question? I think, again, I go back to this idea that it's situational, right? You, on the one hand, you know, you can see plenty of evidence that there is a real social force to these ideas. But you don't have to make the same interpretive leaps that I document in the book. You know, it does take a little bit of practice, but you can become really kind of alert to or aware of moments in which it gets used, this kind of discourse or these ideas, and moments when it does not. And even when it does happen, if you will, that people use these things, you still don't know necessarily what that means. And so you just have to really be alert. When is it used? When is it not used? What are the effects of its use? It's not a given fact, but it is a social fact with force. And there's one example I remember being really interested in. I saw a newspaper article when I was doing my research in which some returnees, in this case, they were returnees who identified as Serbs, were returning to an area that was identified as a Croat majority area in Herzegovina. And there was a newspaper article in which the returnees were complaining about the misappropriation of funds by the local mayor. And it seemed ripe for the article to be about ethnic difference, right? So the local Croat mayor was appropriating funds that should have been used to support the return of Serbs, and instead had, you know, redirected those funds to something else. And what was and this was an article being written by a newspaper in a Serb majority area that had a majority of Serbian or Serb readers. So you would think it was like tailor-made for an article to be about kind of, you know, the poor, persecuted Serbs in this corrupt majority area. And yet that didn't come out at all in the article. Instead, it was about the corruption of the local mayor and not about his anti, you know, whatever Serbness. And it had people, it quoted returnees criticizing the mayor, but really only in terms of the, using the idiom of corruption. So here's a moment where you would think, you know, groupness or the categories of ethnic difference, you know, would seem tailor-made for it, and yet it wasn't used at all. And so that's the kind of moment where you kind of think, oh, this is interesting. Why the discourse of corruption and not the discourse of ethnic difference and persecution? And those are the kinds of things you can be alert to, because I have a feeling they happen all the time, and but they don't rise to the level of kind of visibility unless we're willing to see them.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think we see also in areas like Sarajevo, sometimes in Banja Luka and Mostar as well, that particularly younger NGO elements, that they are basically saying, well, our issue with this politician is not that person's ethnicity. Our issue with this politician is that he or she has not fulfilled the promises they made. He or she is ruling over the municipality in a corrupt way, etc. And at the same time, we obviously know that the fog of ethnicity, one could perhaps call it, is still very thick and used often very effectively, and not just by politicians, to obfuscate perhaps the more pressing issues at hand in contemporary Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, your book correctly, and in many ways throughout the book, in fact, emphasizes the fallacies of various foreigners who've worked in Bosnia and Herzegovina over the years. And I should note that in your concluding chapter, you also draw some connections to, in particular, the international experience in Afghanistan. Could I challenge you to apply that same criticism, which you rightly apply to foreigners, to the way in which citizens of Bosnia and Herzegovina regard the so-called international community and its members? In particular, would you agree that the local perspective on the international community can also be extremely reductionist and in essence regard the international community as some kind of monolith?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very clear that people work from a knowledge base of a particular kind. And when that knowledge base is partial, incorrect, or non-existent, then they draw upon certain kinds of things that they hear about and then make conclusions based upon that, which is just to say that, as you note in the book, I really, you know, I wanted us, you know, I want the readers to say, you know, think about what it is to be, you know, a member of the international community, quote unquote, arriving into Bosnia for the first time. You know very little about Bosnian, you know, history, culture, maybe just what you've read a bit in the newspapers. You certainly don't speak the language. You might not even be able to read, you know, all the alphabets that the language comes in. And yet you are expected to profoundly have a positive effect on this country. And this produces some real challenges. And much of the book details what those challenges are. At the same time, you have, you know, people who live in Bosnia and Herzegovina have their whole lives, you know, deeply embedded in the local society. And here come these foreigners, and they're trying to make sense of what are they doing here? How do I interpret what they say and what they do? And that, of course, is going to be very, very partial. It's going to depend upon maybe what they read or hear about in public media, maybe some direct interactions, but it is going to be, of course, also very partial And of course, stereotypes abound, both about internationals and, you know, how wealthy they are or how ignorant they are. But also what I found in my research was a lot of similar kinds of, you know, national thinking, which may be a very particularly European thing, right? So they would say, they would first want to figure out, okay, here's a member of the international community, but where are they from? Ah, they're a German. Aha, now I know a thing or two about them.
Exactly.
Or they're a Swede, or they're, you know, a Canadian. And, but then the other thing that got me interested was how then people in Bosnia, how they saw or how they kind of approached things that were, quote, international or the international community as a way to make sense of geopolitics and their place within those geopolitical relationships. And so, you know, they would say, okay, this person is, you know, an American, and I know I have some ideas about, you know, American politics, and therefore I should approach them in this kind of a way because I know that American politicians you know, speak this way about Bosnia. You know, so it was really a kind of a very interesting everyday geopolitics being played out, you know, in Bosnia in these interactions. And then the last thing I'll say about this is, and I detail this in the book, the same way in which, you know, Bosnians were being seen by foreigners, you know, through the lens of these ideas about, you know, ethnicity, which is to say, once I know what your ethnic identity is, then I can connect you with a bunch of other people who have the same identity and kind of make assumptions based on that. The same thing happened with foreigners. Like, oh, you're a member of the OHR. Well, now I'm going to associate you with all statements made by people who are with this organization and actually make you responsible for what they say. And that to me was a very interesting phenomenon, as some, you know, member of the OHR would say, well, just because they said that in Sarajevo, that's not what I think. And you can't assume that I'm responsible for what they do there because I'm, and, you know, kind of here and I'm not connected with that. And so just again, those kinds of, you know, stereotyping or ways in which people would get slotted into certain you know, categories and then assumptions be made about them. That was something that both Bosnians and foreigners kind of participated in all the time.
You had me here while I was listening to your response, almost channeling images of both Danis Tanovic's Ničija Zemlja, No Man's Land, which has such scenes, including about Germans, and also Pierre Jalitza's great film Gori Vatra. In English, it's known as The Fuse, which also has some very caricaturized, but also, I think, very recognizable scenes of interaction between international representatives and Bosnians. And I think as a former employee of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, I know it could be frustrating that you know, The Hague was a catch-all term for anybody associated with the ICTY. And you catch yourself thinking, hey, wait a second, you know, I work for the Office of the Prosecutor. Have you stopped to consider that we may not actually agree with everything that the trial chamber or some other organ of the court pronounces? Of course, at the same time, as you say, you know, these are very understandable statements from people who, for various reasons, are not able to or do not have access to the type of information which would allow them to reach more nuanced assessments of a particular international organization. Now, and of course, the language barrier works to both ways, right? I mean, a lot of Bosnians, particularly of older generations, are viewing everything through whatever they have available in their own language and are not able to read a lot of the information that international organizations produce. Now, in my own experience, and rightly so, one of the frequent gripes many Bosnians have had over the years is that many foreign employees in the country can be very patronizing and vastly underestimate the extent to which Yugoslavia was a modern, highly developed, and in many respects effective society prior to the war. Sometimes Bosnians vent this complaint by themselves referring in a very derogatory way to allegedly primitive countries in places like sub-Saharan Africa. But putting aside that particular kind of othering, can you give us some examples from your book or from your field research of how much of what Bosnian society needed after the war was actually, in a way, ironically, in place prior to the war?
Yeah, that's a really, you know, interesting and important question. And so I give different examples in the book of how this works, but perhaps the most prominent one is around the idea of the rule of law. I give this example in the book where returnees who identified as Serbs in Sanski Most, which was then a Muslim majority area, would complain about the fact that when the municipality had job openings, that no Serbs seemed to be hired. And they would go to the OSCE, who had a local office in this town, and complain and say, can you do something about this? And the OSCE would say, well, we certainly can't give you, you know, force the municipality to give Serbs jobs. But what we can do is help the local municipality to develop fair hiring practices. And then we can monitor future job announcements to make sure those fair hiring practices are followed. And this was against the, you know, the generalized backdrop that somehow the problem was in Bosnians' commitment to the rule of law. And to, you know, something like fair hiring practices that would prevent corruption and other kinds of things. And I show in the book, because I have the wonderful example of research done by Robert Hayden in the 1980s, he wrote a book on Yugoslav worker courts. And he did research in the courts themselves, and he said that one category of regular complaint that was dealt with in the worker courts was precisely around the idea of unfair hiring. So in other words, already existing in Yugoslavia in the 80s was a court system that people would bring complaints about unfair hiring. And he noted that often the people who complained would win their cases. And in fact, the court would order either them to be instated or for the process to be redone. So in other words, here you had an already existing, you know, kind of functioning and often satisfying way for people to deal, you know, through a kind of rule of law framework with the issue of unfair hiring practices. And so what became interesting for me was to see or think or wonder why it was that foreigners could ignore that, right? How they could come to, you know, fail to be aware of that. And in part, I say it's a generalized ignorance about, you know, Yugoslav history, but even more so, it's because it would probably force them to question what it is they were doing in Bosnia in the first place, right? So as I mentioned in the book, foreigners were not experts in Bosnian history, society, culture, or Yugoslav or regional anything. They were experts in things like the rule of law, free and fair elections, gender mainstreaming. And for them to recognize that there was already a kind of existing court system that perhaps unevenly, but nevertheless to some degree successfully was functioning before the war would maybe force them to question what it is that they were doing there and what they had to bring or contribute. And of course, as I show in this example in the book, their offer to help, you know, develop free and fair hiring practices and monitor those practices was largely rejected by Bosnians as a poor solution to the problem that they had identified. So that's just one example. There's lots of others that we could point to about how that kind of ignorance about Bosnian society and culture and history, you know, really, really led to these kinds of profound kind of misunderstandings. And in ways that usually stigmatize Bosnians in the intervention encounter.
No one likes to reinvent a wheel, especially when it is another group telling you that you don't have a properly functioning wheel, and you know pretty well that you've had one for a while. Although I would have to add, and I was a little bit surprised that this didn't come up in your book. I've seen it in the work of Elisa Helms and others, that I think all of that having been said, and I agree completely with your analysis, I think experience shows that in some cases, the understandable frustration and reticence on the part of various Bosnian actors was sometimes modified or, let's say, canceled out by the prospect of generous funding, right? Because that certainly, not to belabor the wheel metaphor, but that did grease some wheels in other necessary respects in a poverty-afflicted post-war society where unemployment was at catastrophically high levels. Now, turning kind of at the end towards your introduction, you state that, and I quote, "My aim is thus to first seek an adequate account of international intervention and then explore the critical possibilities that such an account makes possible," end quote. I imagine that this is a question you might want to avoid, and I kind of think that you do actually to some extent avoid it in your book, and perhaps rightly so, but here it comes. What are your actual prescriptions for fixing the deficiencies your book identifies, not only in Bosnia and Herzegovina, but also in other societies where we have large-scale international intervention?
Yeah, and you know, you're right that that's a question that I resist answering in the book, in part because, well, there's a variety of reasons. Often, you know, part of it was just because it's such a strong feature of other books that I felt that one of those or other studies, one of the kinds of things that I felt in the need to write the book was that we actually need better accounts of what is happening in these sites of intervention, and not to rush or always be looking at the way things ought to be, but first to get a good account of the way they actually are. And to that end, I think my book offers useful guidelines on how that can be done. And as you mentioned earlier, at the end of the book, I offer an example of how to use one of the concepts from the book to understand intervention in Afghanistan. But when it comes to prescriptions, I think we need to proceed with a real healthy sense of scholarly and political humility before the complexity and open-ended nature of engagements across social and cultural difference. That said, I don't think we can or ought to live in a world without transnational action that responds to the conditions that provoke interventions in the first place, right? Armed conflict continues, natural and man-made disasters continue, poverty has not gone away, and so on, right? Those are the things that usually provoke or demand kind of transnational action and intervention. And I would also add that for those of us living in the countries of the global north, our governments and our societies are already involved in these places through the extraction of natural resources, consumption patterns, arms sales, the influence of market forces, histories of colonial relations, migration policy, and so on, right? There's no innocent external position. There's no neutral position. And so with that being said, I think that one of the things I would say, and these are not very specific prescriptions, they're more general, but one thing that I just come back to again and again and again is the point that greater resources does not equal greater expertise or authority or morality. It's often taken that that's the way, you know, that we come in to intervene in the situation and we have more resources at our disposal. And that is automatically means that we know what ought to be done and we know what's right in the situation. And it's just not the case. And so we have to resist this idea that just because one group might have more resources, more money, more at their disposal, that they do not necessarily know what ought to be done better than those people who are on the ground. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this is perhaps a no-brainer at this point after all the discussion that we've had, and that is that, you know, what needs to be foregrounded in these moments is the knowledge, experience, and history of those whose lives are at stake, right? And that means, of course, developing the capacities to understand those things. And that might mean accepting that you're at a disadvantage and might need to let someone else lead in certain moments. And you have to be willing to dwell outside of your comfort zone. Again, none of these are easy kinds of observations, but I think that they're critical if international interventions going forward are not to repeat the mistakes or confront the challenges that are documented not only by me, but by so many others. And maybe the last thing I'll just say is that those who are intervening need to be willing to acknowledge that they may not have the answers in advance, that there are no easy solutions. And instead, they might need to create something in common that emerges out of the encounter, even if you do not know in advance what that might be, and even if it might require suspending certain sensibilities. Again, someone might, you know, hear me say that and say, well, that's all a fantasy. That's not the way the world works. But that is maybe the way the world ought to work if we're not to have repeat some of these same problems. So that's about as far as I'll go in responding to the what is to be done question.
Well, you went further than I'd expected. And I also have to say that I think your answers to this difficult question are very grounded in your experience. And I can recognize them from my own experience. And I agree with the suggestions you're coming with. I mean, they also relate obviously to the notion that whether we as international actors are there for 16 months or 6 years, and you mentioned this from one of your informants in the book, I mean, one day we will leave and they will still be living there. And that should always be at the forefront of our minds. And I think this collaborative, more mutually respective approach, where we don't fly in with cookie cutter solutions, and where we recognize that just because a society like Yugoslavia, or one could take, for example, Ethiopia, or other countries around the world, just because they do at one point in time end up in fratricidal warfare and state collapse, we need to avoid what, you know, historians would call teleological perspectives, where we read everything as a failure just because it ended that way in the end, right? And, you know, you mentioned the global north, without, being, a Cassandra, I would say that, you know, the fragile current state of U.S. democracy, also has, you know, structural components, but would again be an excellent example that if and when things do go wrong, that doesn't mean that there's nothing to be salvaged from what came before, right? And I think that's really important to keep in mind with socialist Yugoslavia and its successor states. Now, for my final question, I'd like you to just imagine the scenario that a younger colleague contacts you, either comes to your office or contacts you, for example, over email and asks you, you know, I've read your book. I find it very inspiring, as I'm sure they will. And if you could do more research or see more research along these lines done, and I'm a young researcher who wants to go out into the field and follow up and pursue some of the things that you've started, what would you like to see explored further?
Yeah. So, and it's funny because to some degree, I would say my immediate response is one that doesn't even sound like it's something new, right? But I do feel like when it comes to the scholarship around international intervention, and this is something that I was hoping to push against a bit with my book, you find kind of two basic camps. The one camp is the, what is that, what I call in the book, the kind of, you know, the success failure paradigm, which is we're going to go in and we're going to evaluate an intervention context to see what was intended and what were the outcomes. And if there was failure, why did it fail? And And there's a lot of that out there, an enormous amount out there, and often documenting shortcomings because it's much easier to do that than, and because they're obvious often and very easy to document, and because people will pay you to do that because they want to figure out why things aren't working the way that some had hoped. And then the other side, the other kind of approach to international intervention is a critical one, which tends to be more about the politics of certain countries than about what's actually happening on the ground, right? So many of the critics of international intervention are not really interested actually in what's happening on the ground in any given context. They're much more interested in critiquing the interveners on a variety of different grounds. And so kind of given that context, what I think would be really useful is to actually find examples of interventions that worked, not in the kind of facile sense of, you know, we wanted to, you know, rebuild 10 schools and we rebuilt 10 schools, but more along the lines of, you know, are there examples of intervention encounters that didn't suffer from some of the kinds of instabilities that I document in the book? Because I think what we need as much right now as critical perspectives on things that don't work, fail, reproduce inequality, et cetera, is we need examples of things that work and understanding why they work. How do they avoid the pitfalls that so many people have documented? And what might there be, you know, to learn from those? Is it possible to have an intervention that is more collaborative, less patronizing, more the product of something, you know, that emerges out of the encounter, rather than all these different kind of instabilities and challenges that come from a kind of ignorance and patriarchal approach? So I suppose that would be kind of like my first thing that pops to mind when asked that question.
Well, that would certainly be I think, fruitful area of or path of inquiry, and I think also a challenging one for any young researcher. So let's hope that some listeners or future students will take up the torch and go down that path. Dear listeners, we've been discussing the book International Intervention and the Problem of Legitimacy, Encounters in Postwar Bosnia-Herzegovina, with my colleague, the cultural anthropologist Andrew Gilbert. Today, I encourage you to read the book. It has a lot of interesting insights and is also, I have to say, at times entertaining in a way one might not expect from such a book, in terms of the anecdotes that are recounted in the course of the book. And I would also mention here at the end that one can also find a bit of entertainment from Andrew Gilbert in the form of his band Fisticuffs Bluff, which I had the chance to check out while I was preparing for this interview. I would in particular encourage you to listen to the song Catholic Dance, which I found to be quite pleasurable listening. So thank you, Andrew, for joining me today for this interview.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And I don't know if I would endorse the same go look for the Fisticuffs Bluff, but if you're a fan of loud, raucous music, it might be entertaining.
We all need to vent and get the steam out in various ways at some point, both internationals and locals, right? So
indeed.
Go check it out. And thank you, everyone, for listening today. Goodbye.